Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 25. The idea that I knew who killed Monica Sonko so consumed me, I automatically pulled in behind Douglas DeWitt when I saw him turning into his driveway. As before, his face clouded with anxiety when he saw me. I held up my right hand in a gesture of appeasement, then yelped when I nicked myself on the edge of the chisel blade protruding from my breast pocket. "May I ask you a few more questions?" I ask, sucking on the resultant small cut on my hand. "I honestly don't think you and your dog had anything to do with Monica's death." He looked at me helplessly.
"But chance it."
I flashed him my most benevolently maternal smile. "A lot's changed since then." "Then what do you want from me?" The guarded look returned. "I want to know what really happened, so I can understand some other things." Although he tried to maintain his defensive facade, I could tell Douglas DeWitt felt greatly relieved. He righted his normally slumped posture, and it surprised me to discover that, quite the opposite of Jeff Weintraub, he was a well-built young man whose carriage made him appear much smaller than he actually was. "It was like I told you. Except that after my dog came back with his ear torn, I went over to Monica's," he admitted evenly. "How come?" I beamed him my most encouraging smile. "To see if there had been a fight." He didn't return the smile, but rather assumed a cautious but determined demeanor as he spoke. "About 6 months ago, there was a semi-serious scuffle and Monica freaked. I could see her really flipping out if Harley drew blood."
"Me too."
I could easily imagine how horrifying such a display of aggression would appear to the timid young woman caught up in an intimate relationship with one of the combatants. I noticed DeWitt looking at me curiously and offered some vague but acceptable explanation for my acquiescence before continuing my inquiry. "What happened when you got to Monica's cottage?" I spoke very gently to ease him over what I suspected would be a very rough spot.
I found her body."
His lower lip trembled perceptibly, and he immediately put up his hand to cover it. "Was Harley with her?" I tactfully observed the lake rather than my companion when I posed the question.
"No."
DeWitt shook his head, a deliberate gesture that appeared to diffuse some of his anxiety. "He was shut up in the bedroom."
"You let him out?"
"Yes." He looked utterly miserable when he confessed this. "I was terrified that my dog had killed her and that I don't know what." "Was the exterior door open or closed?" I deliberately kept my voice neutral when I raised the critical point.
"Closed."
He looked at me in astonishment. "Cripe! I was so scared, I never even thought about that." "You took my card, didn't you?" I ticked another DeWitt question off my mental list. "I panicked when I saw it, just grabbed it and ran," he replied, looking more contrite than I believed possible. "I was afraid Monica had called you about the Schutzhund training." He looked at me expectantly, and I debated whether to tell him the real reason she had called. In the end, his guileless expression once again led me to keep the details of the visit to myself. "She called me about training Harley." I closed the subject firmly and immediately opened another I knew would distract him. "Why did you give my card to McCarthy?" Douglas DeWitt's face turned a ripe tomato red. "I didn't," he grimaced apologetically. He evidently saw it on the table when he stopped in to pick up some files my dad had me bring up here for him. "What did he say when he saw it?"
"I wasn't there when he found it."
I didn't even realize it was gone until I got a letter from him about it. I looked at him so inquisitively, he knew exactly what I wanted to know. The gist was that, since the cottage was in a cell phone dead zone and I never seemed to be home or inclined to answer the landline, and he was so pissed that he'd wring my bloody neck if he saw me face to face anyhow, he strongly suggested I not say a word about the missing business card, or where I found it, to anyone, if I wanted to live to see my bloody 23rd birthday. Told me to stay put and let him handle it. Douglas DeWitt rattled off the letter's contents as if he'd read them repeatedly. Then he grinned meekly. Trouble was, I only checked that post office box because the old guy at the post office said there was something in it for me. Chan would have really wrung my bloody neck if he knew I didn't get his letter until yesterday. I smiled at this revelation, then explored the subject of the teacher, consultant, writer, maybe sometimes cop spook further. Did you think he could handle it? I asked, recalling my own reservations regarding that matter. I didn't know if he could or not, but it wasn't like he gave me much choice. A shy smile lit up the young man's features. I did know he knew a lot about police work, and that Dad had hired him to find the goat. The goat belongs to your father. I felt obligated to verify one of the few details of the case that McCarthy had deemed fit to share with me. Dad's department. He's department head, but he's more than that, too. The words began to tumble out of Douglas DeWitt, as if he'd suddenly made up his mind that he could trust me. That's why I hired Chan, and why I was so scared about what happened to Monica. You lost me. I held up my hand to slow him down when he paused long enough to look at me. He took a deep breath and his face clouded with concentration as he made an obvious attempt to organize his thoughts. Dr. Winthrop left Dad in charge while he went to Europe to negotiate some new contracts. He resumed much more slowly. He's fair, but very tough, and Dad knew that how he handled the goat business could make or break him. The young technician paused to take another deep breath before he continued. That put Dad under tremendous pressure, and knowing I was mixed up in Monica's death would have made it 10 times worse. He and Mom really pushed me to get involved in Schutzhund, and if my dog had killed someone, they never would have forgiven themselves. Worse, Dr. Winthrop might have seen Dad's encouraging me to do it as a lack of judgment on Dad's part that might carry over to his work in the lab. Where does Hal fit in? I asked, recalling Pamela Winthrop's bitterness over her father-in-law's appointment of some flunky to run the company in his absence. Hal works for Dad. Harold Winthrop Jr. works for your father? I couldn't keep the bewilderment out of my voice. It was more like Dad got stuck with him. The younger DeWitt smiled shyly again. But because Hal was the boss's son, Dad felt he had to know if Hal was involved with a missing goat before he notified the police. Did your father really think Hal could have stolen the goat? Dad considered it a definite possibility, he conceded candidly. I guess Hal overheard Dr. Winthrop telling Dad and some of the other department heads that Hal wasn't doing much for the company. Later, Hal said some things that made Dad think Hal wanted to get even with his dad for saying that. What do you think? Douglas DeWitt appeared to grow before my eyes when he realized his opinion genuinely interested me. I think it was a legitimate fear, he acknowledged without hesitation. I didn't have that much contact with Hal, but from what little I did, I thought he stood to lose a lot if his dad reorganized the company based strictly on merit. I was surprised as everyone else when I heard Jeff stole the goat. To tell you the truth, he grinned at me impishly. I didn't think he had the balls to do it. I was a little surprised myself, I laughed. You will tell your father I appreciate him getting those samples back for me, won't you? The young man looked momentarily flustered. Oh, sure. I'll give him the message. His smile conveyed more bewilderment than comprehension, but at that moment I had more important things to do than wonder why. I turned toward my car to leave at the same time as Douglas DeWitt glanced down at his watch. "Why don't you stick around a little longer?" he suggested amiably. "I expect Chan any minute." The idea of facing my sometimes partner with breaking and entering paraphernalia bulging from my pockets and enduring another cookie-baking lecture made me feel suddenly woozy. I waved what I hoped looked like a menopausal rather than guilty hand in front of my face. "I'd love to." I dragged the same hand across my forehead in a sweat-mopping gesture. "But I really must get going." I slid into my car with the idea of getting out of there as quickly as possible. But then one last DeWitt-related loose end popped into my head. "Does McCarthy know you sent me those threats?" I asked as I turned the key in the ignition. The young man blanched and shrank. "He'd kill me if he knew I did such a stupid thing," he confessed miserably. "And that'd only be half of what Dad would do." "Then I suggest you get rid of that damn green paper before he sees it. And maybe that computer and printer, too." I grinned at him. "But how? You're not?" He stammered helplessly. "I'm just glad that particular fear was only in my mind," I explained as I put the car into gear and let out the clutch. "Not too many things have fallen into that category lately." I left Douglas DeWitt looking bewildered yet again, one hand raised in a parting gesture. Only when I slowed to a crawl to navigate the particularly treacherous stretch of road approaching the long driveway to Journey's End did I realize I'd forgotten to ask him why he sent the threats. But what he'd told me about Hal Winthrop concerned me far too much to let it bother me. Secure in the knowledge that the Winthrops and their dog worked and played miles away in Massachusetts, I parked in their driveway and quickly walked to the back of the house. I told myself I'd break in using the same window McCarthy did, as a matter of pride. However, it became a matter of comedy when I discovered, as he undoubtedly had, that the basement window I thought had been accidentally left open during my previous escapade was, in fact, missing a lock altogether. Although I'd looked forward to seeing what I could accomplish with my wood chisel and itty-bitty pliers, my much greater desire to explore the house made me more than happy to crawl through the window and onto the table and floor below. As I commenced my investigation of the large area, illuminated only by the dim light that filtered through the two small casement windows, I remembered that this time I didn't need to stumble around in the darkness. I only needed to stumble to the nearest light switch. Which I did. Once I turned on the lights, both the size and relative emptiness of the basement room surprised me. An impressive assortment of expensive fitness equipment did take up one end of the space, and the pile of odds and ends I remembered did take up the other. But the center and largest portion of the room stood virtually empty. I tried to summon an image of what the Winthrops might do in such a space, then decided they probably didn't do anything in it at all, when no acceptable explanation occurred to me. They probably hadn't been down there in years. I'd almost succeeded in convincing myself of this when I noticed the row of empty yogurt containers lined up on the floor next to the wall. The furry gross lining the first of these made it perfectly clear that, whatever else Pamela Winthrop might be, she wasn't much of a housekeeper. But she was a creature of habit, I acknowledged with grim satisfaction when I peered into the container at the opposite end of the row and estimated its residue no more than a few days old. I sat down on the floor next to the empty cups and allowed my gaze to drift, consumed by the desire to know what the Winthrops did there besides eat yogurt. After a while, I realized that my eyes kept returning to the same two objects, the roll of matting in the corner and the old dress form on the leading edge of the clutter at the opposite end of the room. Slowly but surely, these two, very real objects, penetrated the barrier of misconceptions I'd accumulated during my brief tenure as a canine crime investigator. Bingo. I leaped to my feet and snatched the padded exercise mat out of the corner and unrolled it on the floor. Only it wasn't an exercise mat, and as soon as I really looked at it, I couldn't imagine how I ever thought it was. It was a padded suit. Any idiot could see that, just as any idiot could see that those gouges around the neck of that dress form didn't come from any pins. I whooped in delight, then regretted I did, when the sound of running footsteps and scrabbling claws on hardwood flooring rained down on me from above. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.